We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about Japan, its politics, and its economy. For much of the post-war period, the Japanese economy grew at a rapid pace, and people there and around the world talked as if this boom time would never end. But it did. The bubble burst. And in the 90s, there was a long period when people in Japan felt that the country had lost its way. Then there was a period of recovery, and just recently, the country, Japan, experienced a significant downturn, just the way that other countries did. And that, no doubt, contributed to the feelings of Japanese as they went to the polls this past summer and handed the party that had been in power for almost all of the post-war period a pretty stunning defeat at the polls. This morning, we'll try to talk a little bit about that and also talk about the way people in Japan and elsewhere thought about economic growth and whether it was a mistake for the Japanese to become so preoccupied with growth. I'd ask perhaps also whether this Japanese experience provides some lessons for the rest of the world. And our guest for the program is Scott O'Brien. He is associate professor in the Departments of History and East Asian Languages and Cultures at Indiana University, Bloomington. He's joining us this morning to talk about Japan, and some of what we'll talk about are some of the things that you will find in a recently published book that he has authored. The title is The Growth Idea, Purpose and Prosperity in Post-War Japan. It's published by the University of Hawaii Press. Questions as we talk certainly will be welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. So locally, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Callers are welcome, but we really urge people to be brief so we can keep moving, get in as many callers as possible, but certainly your comments and questions are welcome. Professor O'Brien, hello.
Good morning, David. Nice to speak with you again.
Well, we appreciate you giving us your time.
Looking forward to it.
I thought that we certainly should start by talking a little bit about this past summer's election and about, and this was in August, about this very dramatic defeat of the LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party, which had been the party in control in Japanese politics for almost all of the post-war period, always having really significant majorities in the parliament, and all the prime ministers were all LDP men. So what was going on in the minds of the Japanese, you think, in August that caused them to hand the LDP this stinging defeat?
Well, I think there was a whole host of frustrations that were long simmering, that were at the root of the election. You know, in many ways, the Liberal Democratic Party, you just mentioned LDP's incredible strength over many, many decades. The party was formed in 1955, and right up until the early 1990s, when just for a brief moment there was a broad coalition that held the prime ministership for not even quite 2 years. So from 55 up to that point, and then again from the mid-90s up until just now, this last summer and early fall, the LDP had held the prime ministerships. And I think what that was about, their long-term success, was an incredible ability to change with changing conditions in both the economic and international political terms. And it seems that with the downturn in the global economy in the last year and a half, LDP's time had just ended. So some of the frustrations that were being expressed, I think, in the election were things that had been gone back even into the 1990s. A lot of long-term systemic dilemmas that Japanese society is facing. I think you and I spoke about some of these a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. right after an election at that time. The economic growth picture in Japan is just one part of the picture. There's also questions related to the total size of the Japanese population. The birth rate in Japan is not replacing the number of Japanese that exist today. the society is rapidly aging, one of the most rapidly aging societies in the world, and also long-term frustration with just what seemed increasingly like political ineptitude or inflexibility, so that the LDP was not able in the new century to rise to the occasion and to come up with policy-making strategies that convinced the majority of Japanese that they could continue on into the next decade and deal with this economic crisis.
Just for a moment to go back to what was going on in 1993, as you mentioned. Now, this was really the only other time when something like this happened, when the LDP—
Almost forgotten. If you heard how people talked earlier this summer, well, it was almost as if that moment hadn't happened.
And that was something I was wondering about, because I do certainly remember that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I wanted to go back and to get in my mind, well, now, when was that exactly and how long did that last?
Yeah.
What was going on there? Are there some parallels between what was going on in 1993 and what's going on now?
I think to a certain extent. In the early 90s, of course, what the economic picture or what was sort of affecting the politics from the economic domain was the event that you referred to, the bursting of the bubble. Just as a caveat, the bursting of the bubble refers to a very specific set of economic dynamics that were put into place in the latter half of the 1980s, a stock market boom that was fueled by land prices and a kind of virtuous cycle, but then becoming a vicious cycle by 1990 and 91 when the crash occurred. But that bubble doesn't refer to all the post-war years of growth and success. So, but nevertheless, it was a devastating moment. And by 92 and 93, it was pretty clear that something had gone drastically wrong. And the Japanese economy was in a state much like the U.S. economy right now and much of the rest of the world, really a financial tailspin with stock prices falling and banks with a lot of bad debt. So that was the kind of economic context of that moment. But in the more exclusively in the political domain, there had been for some time, beginning in the 80s and up into the early 90s, frustration with the political system in Japan to come up with new and dynamic policy orientations. There was a lot of talk about needing to shift some elements of the electoral system, the very way in which members of the parliament, the Diet, were elected, and a lot of debate about attempting to come up with some system in Japan that would be more like a two-party system, with the idea that was a more robust economic political system of conceptual and policy give and take than the very fractured multi-party system that existed in Japan and still in many ways does today. So that political set of frustrations was also there, and you had some breakaway members of the LDP in this early 1990s moment. The most famous and charismatic and even telegenic of those being Hosokawa, and he became the prime minister in 1993, only for a very short time, and as the head of a broad coalition of essentially all the other non-LDP parties. It was not the same situation as today when the Democratic Party of Japan has an overwhelming majority of seats in the House.
Hmm. Well,
And then one other thing, David, just to add, sure. I know you and I talked about this about a year and a half ago or so. The other thing that's sort of similar but also slightly different in today is Hosokawa was seen as a very charismatic type, a young politician. He was compared at the time to Kennedy from the American political scene in the 60s. He was seen as more of a straight shooter, as a bit of a rebel. He had formed this new party and left the LDP. And in a lot of ways, people are looking to Hatoyama, the current prime minister, the one who just came into office, to see is he going to be that sort of person. He doesn't seem to have the political charm or the mass media savvy perhaps as Hosokawa. But like Koizumi Junichiro from earlier in this decade, Hatoyama there's a lot of hopes being invested in him as a person who'll be able to break through some of the political and policy-making log jams of the Japanese political system.
Yeah. The thing that I was going to ask it there, was the recovery of the LDP. Does that say more about the LDP and its strength, or does that really speak to the inability of the coalition that came to power at the time really to hold itself together?
I think, take the easy way out, it's a little bit of both. But the LDP still in the mid-1990s had a lot of very strong individuals who were members of the party in its main factions. The party is sort of a broad umbrella in some ways and has many different factions within it, led by some pretty powerful people. So that led to that gave the LDP a good base from which to bounce back from this sort of short-term defeat in the early 1990s. And on the other side, as I said, the prime ministerships from 93 to 94 were prime ministerships over broad coalitions of very small parties. One of them was Hosokawa's party, and another was the Socialist Party prime minister, Murayama, also a very short-lived prime ministership. There were actually three prime ministers during that time who were non-LDP folks within those 2 years or so in the early 90s. And that coalition just did not hold together. And the sort of frustration with the LDP that was brewing even within the party as these splinter groups sort of peeled off had not coalesced into a strong organized opposition approach until I think just about now. The Democratic Party of Japan looks like it could have a potential to be a very strong long-run party and perhaps one that would vie for power perennially with the LDP, and perhaps it would be a sort of power shifting between those two parties for some time to come. Of course, no one knows. But again, this old idea going back 20, even 25 years, that Japan somehow the political system needs to erect a two-party system, more like the system in the parliamentary political system of Britain, or like the U.S. presidential and congressional system in the United States, still is alive. This idea is still alive.
You headed off my next question, and that would be really is what we're seeing here the beginning of a permanent change in Japanese politics, or a long term change, or is this just going to be a blip like 93?
Yeah, I think it's hard to tell. I think this is a much more fundamental change than 93. I think the Democratic Party of Japan is clearly much stronger. I mean, its electoral victory was resounding. It was a crushing defeat for the LDP. And again, in that way, there's no similarity whatever. It has enough seats in the parliament to really control the prime ministership at this point, essentially on its own. There could be elections coming down the road where there needs to be a small coalition government. The Democratic Party of Japan may need to bring in some smaller parties. But unless the LDP bounces back pretty quickly, I think that this could be a midterm sort of arrangement here where you have LDP, DPJ competition for prime ministerships.
The guest that we have here in this part of Focus 580 is Scott O'Brien. He is associate professor in the Departments of History and also East Asian Languages and Cultures at Indiana University, Bloomington. We're talking about Japan. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, what can you tell us about Yukio Hatoyama, the man who is now the prime minister?
Well, he comes from like a lot of Japanese politicians who make it to this level. He comes from a long line of politicians and very prominent politicians. His grandfather was prime minister in the 1950s, 54 to 55 time frame, Hatoyama Ichiro. His family is described, and you'll see how often the Kennedy family is invoked in Japan. The Hatoyama family is described as sort of a Kennedy-like political family in the Japanese political system. So he has long roots, but other prime ministers have had that in recent times as well, and it hasn't necessarily led to any particular long-term contemporary success. So that by itself doesn't really tell us a whole lot about what's going to happen to Hatoyama, but it does give an indication of the nature of the Japanese political system as these individuals move up through the party system and eventually rise to the level of high national leadership. His Democratic Party of Japan was formed in the late 1990s, so sort of post Hosokawa and that early defeat of the LDP. Again, part of an ongoing long-term attempt to form an opposition party that could have some success in competition with the LDP. And his platform, there's a lot that remains to be seen. And from the American context, there's been a lot of debate about whether there's going to be some sort of fundamental shift in the relationship between the United States and Japan. This has been a bilateral alliance. It's been incredibly important, of course, to Japan over the many decades since the U.S. occupation of Japan in the late 40s and early 1950s, and also has been important to the United States during the Cold War era, of course, and continuing up to today. The American military bases in Japan are the largest bases in Asia. There's upwards of 50,000 American service personnel in Japan and in bases all over the country. And some of the early expressions of the DPJ before the election sounded as if they were going to reconsider possibly or revisit some elements of the U.S.-Japan alliance. I don't think in the long term there's going to be any grand change. I think that what's being expressed here by Hatoyama and his party is the idea that Japan needs to be more assertive and may go its own way in certain certain regional policy decisions in East Asia. This is something that again, Japanese have been saying to themselves for a very long time and never quite actually putting into actual policy practice. It remains to be seen if Hatoyama's administration will be any different. Mm-hmm. On the economic side, in terms of domestic policy, Hatoyama's party is sort of a left central party, more liberal than the LDP, despite the name of the Liberal Democratic Party. It's a conservative party. There's still, again, a lot to be seen there in terms of what actual policy approaches the Hatoyama administration will take. But he has come out again in rather provocative language condemning the market fundamentalism that he attaches to the U.S. approach to global economics. Of course, in the recent downturn, this made good electoral sense in the context of an election when the Japanese economy was really going off a cliff. The recession in Japan is far worse than in any other country, perhaps excepting Iceland, where the entire financial system went bankrupt. The Japanese economy this year is looks like it may contract by 6% the GDP. So it's a very dramatic context, and it makes good electoral sense to go out and condemn the U.S. kind of free market economics to a certain extent. But there again, I'm not sure there's going to be any real fundamental change. Japan is a capitalist country. There may be some changes around the margins. So on both those scores, I think there's a sort of a wait-and-see attitude that both the U.S. and people inside of Japan are taking to see what is really going to happen.
Hmm. You talked a little bit earlier about the things that were on people's minds. And
yes.
One certainly and these are trends I think we've been seeing in Japan for a long time, is that the serious declines in birth rate and the ever growing average age of the Japanese, so that they have a lot of people in the older age cohorts, and that's only expected to continue. Has he, that is Mr. Hatoyama, said anything specific about how his government would address that?
Yes, that is one element in which there has been a bit of specificity. One of the platforms that he is pursuing in his prime ministership is to make child allowances to families with children, monthly allowances of something like, depending on the exchange rate, between $200 and $300 a month to help support families who have children. This is one of a series of measures that have been bandied about for quite some time, even under the LDP prime ministerships, aimed at trying to encourage families to have more children.
And is there a concern about social welfare issues that have to do with the elderly? And is that something that the government really addresses, or is that something that is more a kind of thing that families have to somehow figure out how to deal with on their own?
Yeah. I mean, I think, as in the U.S., there's a lot of public discourse about the problem and debates and sort of a gnashing of teeth involved in trying to figure out what to do in a social sense or a political sense. But a lot of this does fall onto private families. Increasingly, there's a variety of experiments going on with settings in which to take care of the elderly. But the overwhelming burden falls on families themselves and taking care of the elderly parents. Of course, in Japan, as in most East Asian countries, the family the traditions of extended family settings is much stronger than it is in the United States. So in some ways, there's a continuation there from much earlier, longstanding cultural patterns. But of course, it becomes a real economic burden when you have over 1 in 5 people in Japan over 65 years of age. And there's no easy solution to the problem. I'm not real sure what Hatoyama's statements on that particular question have been, to be very honest with you. But it's not a unique problem to his administration. It's not a new problem, as you say. Really, almost as long as I've been studying Japan, you know, as a graduate student and now as a faculty member, this has been an ongoing issue and not one easy to address. Part of the problem in Japan is that Japan, Japanese national policy continues to be one that is very dubious about the idea of making Japan an immigrant country. There have been periods in which workers, those wishing to come to Japan to make higher wages than they can in their home country, have flowed into Japan to do short-term labor. I remember in the very early 1990s, really before the bubble burst, seeing a lot of individuals from the Middle East doing labor on work sites. And there are other examples of this from different national settings. But it's still very difficult, and national policy does not in any way throw open the doors of Japan's the immigration gates to workers coming in or for immigrants who want to make a life in Japan and become Japanese national citizens. It's still relatively extremely difficult to do that in Japan. So that there's there's sort of a catch-22 going on here in Japan in which it's very difficult to promote birth rate increases, and yet you're not allowing a lot of new people to come into the country to set up and make lives in Japan and support the aging population in that way. So it's a real dilemma.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is Scott O'Brien. He is associate professor in the departments of history and also East Asian languages and cultures at Indiana University, Bloomington. We're talking about Japan. He's the author of a recently published book about the Japanese economy and how people in Japan thought about growth. The title of his book is The Growth Idea, Purpose and Prosperity in Post-War Japan, and it's recently come out from the University of Hawaii Press. Questions, welcome, 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. To shift back again and talk a little bit about the economy, people yes. will again remember the boom time, particularly peaking in the 80s, when they will also remember, I'm sure, in popular media in this country, there was this huge preoccupation with Japan, its economic power, and its power to rival the United States. And that was something that people in this country thought a lot about, and people in Japan did too. And I was thinking about the fact that, they had this long period of prosperity until the 90s, that there would have been an entire generation of Japanese that wouldn't have known anything else. That they would have, all they would have known was this period of really spectacular growth and great economic power that Japan had. And I could imagine how people, if that was all they knew, how they would have felt when they got to the 90s, and then essentially they had a decade when the country was in recession. That must have had a very serious, you know, very serious impact on the mood and the thinking and the maybe even the very identity of Japanese people.
Yeah, I mean it's a very basic point when looking back at contemporary history of Japan and then linking that up to earlier decades of 20th century history and trying to figure out what sort of what this history is really telling us and also what sort of story it makes sense to tell about the nation of Japan. One of the things I'm interested in this book, The Growth Idea, is the ways in which we kind of narrate Japan as a national story. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of interest in trying to reconceive the certain kind of the plot points that we give that story, and maybe we'll touch on a little bit of that. But there is no doubt that in the public psyche, as seen in the national debate in general interest magazines, on TV, in political elections, on college campuses, that there was a sense of foreboding as the decade stretched on in the 1990s, and Japan was either during that time in recession or essentially at flat growth or almost essentially negligible growth, and it was so dramatically different than what had occurred in prior decades, even prior to the bubbles of the 1980s, the late 1980s, which was an exceedingly exciting but also eventually dangerous time, much like in the U.S. prior to 2008. Even prior to those decades, such high growth for so long that it did come as a shock. The decade by the end of the 1990s, and this was, by the way, the first – another way to talk about that time period is to call it the first Heisei era decade in Japan when the new emperor came to the throne. Hirohito died in 89, and there was a new reign name period. So by the end of the so-called Heisei period, that is the end of the 1990s as it turns out, people were talking about that decade as a lost decade or the Heisei depression or recession. And so clearly there's a lot of psychological and identity conflict going on in dubbing the history of a country over a 10-year period as lost. And there's no way to discount the severe constellation of economic dilemmas that the Japanese society was facing at that time. On the other hand, one of the things I like to say, and I sort of start my book out in this mode, trying to be slightly polemical here, but I think there's some good food for thought in this idea, and that is, again, what does it mean to talk about a country as having lost an entire decade? It is true that Japanese economy was not growing as fast as it had been. On the other hand, Japan still was the second largest economy in the world, and by some measures continues to be. Obviously, China, the PRC, is growing extremely rapidly and will eventually replace Japan as the second largest economy, and by that matter will eventually replace the United States, no doubt, mm-hmm. as the first. But by lots of other measures, Japan was still an incredibly successful society. And one of the things I'm interested in is the way in which the way we tell the story about Japan is that because it was so successful when it grew, that when it's not growing, that's sort of all we can really think about. And Japan still has an incredibly rich society. Recent measures still show that its per capita GDP, its per capita economic output is still up in the top two or three in the entire world. They Japanese live longer than anybody else on the planet. That culturally, this is something I think you and I may have talked about in our earlier discussion a couple of years ago. Culturally, Japanese culture is now part of global culture mm-hmm. in a way that in earlier decades only Hollywood perhaps and other aspects of American free market national international corporations held that sort of position. The students in my class has come to learn about Japan still in surprising numbers despite this idea of a lost Japan, and it's because not of Japan's GDP growth but because of culture. They're interested in anime, Japanese animation. They're interested in manga. They're interested in video gaming, in Japanese movies, and in some historical topics as well, which of course warms the heart of myself as a historian. They're interested in samurai still. It's a perennial topic of interest. So – There's other ways to think about that decade, and but the truth is, as you are suggesting, Japanese themselves don't always do this. So, the sense of identity crisis, I think, is very strong, and I think in a lot of ways there is a lot of fear in Japan. It has to do with economic power and the sense that it's slipping away, and it also has to do with Japan's place in the region that it occupies. The rise of the PRC in economic and now increasingly in political terms is a very different context than Japan existed in all through the post-war period, and I think there is a lot of flailing about in Japanese international policy and domestic policy in that context.
Mm-hmm. Well, here you made the point very well that I think is one of the central ideas that you explore in the book, and just to underline it because I think it's interesting, and I think you could also make the point that it gives you something to think about no matter where you are, whether you're in Japan or somewhere else, because it makes you think about how one thinks about growth, that you could have a place like Japan where, yes, it's true that, the 90s, there were some bad things about the 90s and it wasn't like the 80s. But on the other hand, as you say, they weren't doing all that badly in the 90s. And yet people felt, because all they could do was look back to the previous decade, somehow people felt that because they had not sustained that growth rate, that somehow that was a failure. And,
Japan
was a failure. And here you could be looking at a country that even then it was the second biggest economy and still is the second biggest economy in the world. Yeah. And yet the Japanese were somehow thinking that the country was a failure.
Yeah. And I think this does point outwards from the story of Japan. I think in the Japanese case, this linkage of national success to GNP growth is really overdetermined. It's an exceedingly strong and sticky link. Which I'm saying is sort of a shame. Japan has a lot more things other than GNP growth. And I think a lot of it has to do with very old-fashioned ideas of saying, gosh, here's this non-Western country that's very capitalistic and almost successful as the United States. Who would have imagined that? And while we won't say those kinds of things in such stark terms out loud now, I think tying the whole story of Japan to this one element, as important as it is in world history, and in Japanese national history, I think is somewhat of a shame. And it does point outwards to the way in which we're all sort of stuck in this kind of prison house, if you will, of economic growth. Of course, we all want Japan to start growing again, and we certainly want the U.S. economy to get going again. No one wants to see people suffering and out of work. There's no way that we can sort of escape our attachment to realizing that unless things are circulating at a certain rate in material terms, people end up out of work. And there's a lot of social suffering that follows from that. On the other hand, you know, in some ways, my book attempts to, from a historian's perspective, show that our way of imagining what an economy should do, this idea of never-ending growth expressed in terms of the statistic of GNP, the idea of high consumption economies, which is an idea that emerges in Japan in the post-war period, all of these things have a history expressed in the way that we express them now. And that history is relatively short-lived. It's a 20th century story, and really it doesn't get going until the early post-war period. And it's leading to problems. I mean, there are planetary limits to what we can materially produce, I would suggest. And the Japanese case, but by historicizing the idea of growth in Japan, where it came from, how it emerged from within the discipline of economics, how very dry topics like the statistic of GNP became such overwhelming political lightning rods, I think it's an important story that helps us understand how we got to this kind of impasse that we're in. I mean, right now we're in an impasse because we're afraid we're not growing. On the other hand, we're increasingly sensing that the idea of never-ending growth in a global sense is going to lead to environmental catastrophe. And it's a conundrum. There's obviously no easy way out of it. But perhaps realizing that there is a history to these ideas helps us at least know that there's a possibility for imagining other alternatives.
Yeah. We have some callers. To get right to them, just very quickly, let me introduce again our guest, Scott O'Brien. He is associate professor in the Departments of History and also East Asian Languages and Cultures at Indiana University, Bloomington. We're talking about Japan. Questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. First up, Effingham, line 4 right here. Hello.
Yes, thank you. It occurs to me, and I agree with your last statement about the growth of capitalist enterprise and all the things that flow behind that are not open-ended. And the destruction of the planet is obvious even now. And the history of how all this occurred, and I think of the Japanese and the black ships and all the other machinations of Western European aggression that has set the world on fire. And how is it possible, and as you've just preempted my question somewhat, to continue that? And a detail I would like you to address. Last night I watched the Frontline, the most recent Frontline, and part of the capitalist system is a closed club called Derivatives.
David, I'm not hearing the question very well. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Okay. Well, my apologies. We can.
I hear a very faint sound, but.
Okay. Well.
There we go.
Is that better now?
Yes. That helps. Thank you. I know you've gone on for some time. I'm sorry. Okay. You could just repeat.
All right. Well,
briefly.
Yes, I want to focus on the black ships. You know,
yes.
When they got to Japan,
yes.
And everything changed the same way. Okay. That practice was around the world. Then capitalism began to mushroom ahead. And last night I watched Frontline, and they had a program about a secret society wherein these capitalist entities operate unregulated in any form. Mm. And they helped bring around this recent collapse of right. The capitalist ideas. And what you would know about that and what the future of that is. And I'll ring off and listen. Thanks.
I think I actually caught a bit of Frontline myself, but I can't really speak to the financial sort of Wall Street leaders and the way in which they were sort of pulling the strings in the larger political system in the U.S. I think that's what that show was about. But I mean, what the caller is referring to with the black ships is the arrival of U.S. warships or steamships with big guns on them in the Bay of Tokyo, then known as Edo, in 1853. This is before the modern political revolution of the Meiji Restoration, after which Japan built a centralized modern nation state on the model of Europe and the United States. And I think the caller is linking American influence around the world perhaps to the broader history of capitalism. I mean, obviously we're reaching sort of far back in the mid-19th century there to link it up to stories today. I think you know, one thing to think about is even America in 1853 and 1854, when they were demanding these new kinds of interaction with the Japanese government of the shogun, was not America of today. The kind of things we associate, and it sounds like the caller does from a critical point of view, with U.S. international capitalism, those changes, of course, occurred to America as well. It's just one thing. As a historian, I'm always trying to historicize and remember things change over time. One way to put that is America, the things we associate with America, and often folks do this around the world in a critical sense, happened to America as well. I mean, America in 1853 or 1920 is not America of 1950, 60, or 2009. I'm not sure beyond that what the caller was hoping to elicit, but
well, I would ask a further question, but I'll tell you what, I have a couple of callers here, and I want to not to keep them on hold. Let's go on, and we'll talk with somebody here in Douglas County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Since economics is your province, I do have a question of that, but I also wanted to see if you could comment on the rather fraught interaction that Gates had just recently. Apparently, I don't know whether they want Japan to do more military spending, which translates to buying more product from the U.S. Something's at stake. Gates actually was holding up the $60 billion remodeling of Guam, which is, I guess, supposed to relieve some of these many bases on Okinawa and perhaps the mainland mm-hmm. as well. I don't know if you have anything on that, but generally in the province of economics, one hears, and maybe this is too glib and I'd like you to see whether it is or not, contrast the Swedish response to the banks having all the bad paper and overextended, et cetera, as opposed to the Japanese, where the Swedes apparently actually wrote down the stuff and the Japanese never did. A lot of people say that that's what continued the stagnation. I don't know if you have an opinion on that, but I hear those. And I guess I'll hang up now and listen off the air.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you. In regard to the U.S.-Japan bilateral security alliance, which is what the caller is referring to in regard to Secretary of Defense Gates and Japanese military spending, I'm not quite up to speed on what this latest incident that the caller was referring to is. But in a broader sense, again, another sort of ongoing debate within Japan and also between the U.S. and Japan relates to the amount of military spending that Japan regularly does. It's far, far less than the United States. Of course, that's true of most countries. But it is a percentage of GDP that comes under sometimes 1% and generally at about 1% of total GDP. And mostly the defense spending is organized around, for the most part, defensive weapons systems as opposed to weapon systems that would allow projecting military power far afield. The U.S. for quite some time, going back into the first Gulf War time in 1990 and 91, were looking increasingly to Japan to take on a more assertive and even military role in the region and around the world, wanting Japan to be a full military partner in this bilateral alliance. There is great hesitancy to do that in the Japanese body politic. Article 9 of the Constitution, of course, famously, at least on paper, outlaws the right to wage war and to have a standing army. Japan does have a military, but it is described as a defense force, which is the kind of loophole there. But a lot of suspicion among many Japanese still of the use of military power, and certainly the awareness that other East Asian countries, China, South Korea, and countries in Southeast Asia are watching and extremely ready to pounce at any moment on even a discussion of the idea that Japan would use military power in anywhere around the world. Now, Japan has over the last decade and a half, or almost two decades now, begun to support U.S. military operations in support roles, but not in actual military active fighting roles. But this, I think, is an ongoing set of of, again, discussions. And with this new regime under Hatoyama, this is precisely one of the things that someone like Gates and in the Obama administration are going to be watching. Is there going to be a real reconsideration or perhaps even pullback from the relationship as it exists already right now?
All right. Let's go. There was another question.
The only thing I would just add very quickly, the caller said economics is my province. It is from the point of view of a historian. I'm not an economist, which I suppose we should have started out by saying. What I'm interested in is the way in which economic ideas have had a life in the body politic and in cultural and sort of national self-identity questions. But in regard to the banking issues in the 1990s, it is clear that one of the critiques of the banks in Japan and broader financial policy was that after the bubble burst in 1990-91 in Japan, that the debt was not written off in the way the callers suggest very nicely, and that was a big mistake, that the debt hung around the necks of the banks for a very long time and was a drag on economic performance in Japan through to the end of the 1990s. And there just was a reluctance to write that debt down and a fear that it would send too many sort of ripples through the financial system. But this is one of the things that people were frustrated with, perhaps in regard to LDP rigidity or an inability to take bold measures.
All right. Let's take another caller here, line two in Champaign. Hello.
Yes. I just have a question regarding diplomacy. Actually, this is Brian from dinner the other night.
Oh, hey, Brian. How you doing?
But very interesting. I don't realize how many good questions I should have asked you at the time. But in any case, diplomacy. One thing I find interesting about the DPJ is there was a Washington Post article this morning. You may have mentioned in the beginning today. I wasn't listening. But, there is this question of, the relationship with the United States and how that might be rethought. And, I find it actually quite interesting. You know, you have this tremendous, economic power that has so many similarities, to the U.S. In terms of global economic changes. We're both in a great decline historically, eventually, right? China is coming in a sense. But at the same time, Japan is just always the follower, right? I mean, there's always this concern in the West over, of course, the recuperation of the far right. And, of course, East Asia in particular is concerned about that. But at the same time, I almost sense it's refreshing to see the DPJ diplomatically, at least, attempt to speak as an equal partner on some level with the United States. And so I find it very interesting. I'm curious where you think that might lead. And it's probably something you can't speak directly. None of us can really speak directly to that. But that does seem to be very different, as Ken Calder was saying in this article I was reading, that it seems very different, something quite new. And it makes me kind of excited in a way. It's very, very interesting. Although I must say I'm not sure the DPJ is necessarily all that more liberal than the LDP, but I think Ozawa and others. But at any rate, just curious your comments on that question.
Yes, thanks, Brian. Relations. Yeah, okay. I mean, the definition of liberal, of course, is all relative. The kinds of policies they were announcing, the sort of projection into the electoral system during the time of the elections was that we are more liberal. We're interested in the common man. It was more of a populist message. I guess that's how I should reframe what I the label I use there. So thank you for that, Brian. In a lot of ways, if you go and look at it, the political analysis of the platforms of the two parties and the actual individuals, as you just mentioned, Ozawa, sort of the string puller in the DPJ, there's a lot of comment that there really is very little that separates the two parties. Of course, you hear that many, many times from different political positions in regard to the Republican Democratic Party here in the United States as well. But that's precisely the point for some in Japan, that at least there would be two parties who you could say were somewhat different or not different enough, and then that system would work better in the long term. I think we did mention it briefly at the very beginning of the show. But one of Hatoyama's more overt stands heading up to the election was to say that perhaps there were some elements of the U.S.-Japan bilateral alliance that's been in place since after the occupation of Japan by the United States and ending in 1952, that perhaps some elements of that need to be revisited. Now, what that meant specifically was completely open, up in the air, and anxiety-provoking from the U.S. point of view. I mean, saying things need to be reconsidered but not giving specificities is not a way of instilling a lot of confidence. I think that long-term, and I think most political observers agree with me, those that are much more expert on this topic than I, that probably there will not be any kind of major shift, but maybe there are some surprises in the works. I don't know what they could be, reducing the number of troops in the in Japan, reducing the number of U.S. troops, or something else. I really don't see that happening in the context of the rise of China, and that's not just an economic rise. The PRC is spending more and more militarily as well year on year. And of course, the political system in Japan is very well aware of that. So I don't see that changing in any broad sense. You know, one of the other ironies of this that I would add to Brian's comments is for many decades, going back to this Gulf War moment, and even really before in the mid 90s under Nakasone, when Ronald Reagan was president in the United States and Nakasone was PM in Japan, there was increasing discussion about Japan now being an economic powerhouse. I mean, the second biggest economy in the world, incredibly rich country, needing to pull more of its weight in world affairs, whatever that meant. By the time of the Gulf War and troubles in the Middle East, it meant very specifically for the U.S. under George W. Bush, under George the Father, rather, that it should be military spending, in fact, even possibly military fighting. And that has been the theme of this sort of long trope in U.S.-Japan relations. Japan should take more of a role for quite some time, of course, more of a military theme. But the irony is that if someone like Hatoyama comes in and says, okay, we're going to be, quote unquote, a normal country, that is to say, have our own international policy and make decisions based on our own national sense of national self-interest, it could mean that Japan takes very different roads than those the U.S. would like them to take. And this is one of the ironies that I've seen for quite a long time. I've never understood U.S. administrations declaring that Japan should take more of a role, be more independent, and have a national policy, when what that might bring in its train is Japan going its own road, and especially in regional issues, as Japan may find that its national self-interest is more closely aligned with East Asia and less with the United States in coming decades. I think that's the thing that over the mid to long term we may see revealing itself.
We have 3-4 minutes left here, and I want to return to a question that I thought I heard the first caller asking, and again stipulating that you're not an economist. I think that there are a lot of people who would say that the international economic collapse that we've seen related to some of the activities that were going on in the financial business was the result of the fact that the things that these large financial institutions were doing were either poorly regulated or maybe not regulated at all. And so Some people say this is a failure of regulation. And what I'm wondering is, in Japan, are there people who say that, who have pointed to the government and said, you've let the big bankers and the investment houses and people in that sector just run wild and do whatever they wanted. And now the problems that we're seeing now here and elsewhere, that's the consequence.
Yeah. Interestingly, in the recent global crisis, the Japanese economy's the hit that it's been taking has not been as much based on a collapse in housing prices or an over-leveraged banking system in more recent years. I mean, that was sort of something that was going on in the early 90s. Japan's already gone through that kind of a bubble. Well, what's happening in Japan in terms of the deep, deep recession and in fact, contraction going on in the economy of, as I said, upwards of 6 or 7% perhaps annually this year, has more to do with the reliance of the Japanese economy internationally on trade. And as the rest of the global economy has become depressed, so has the Japanese economy. But I think in regard to regulation, again, perhaps ironically, over a number of decades now, the argument has been both from the outside looking into Japan, especially from the U.S. point of view, and among some inside of Japan, that what the Japanese economy needed to do was deregulate. There was too much regulation. Now, that might not be so much in regard to the financial sector, but certainly in regard to things like importing and exporting and manufacturing and sort of so-called structural barriers to the ability of other companies to come into Japan, thus keeping consumer prices in Japan artificially high and retarding economic growth. The arguments have been about deregulating, not more regulation in Japan in recent decades.
Well, we're coming down to the point here where we have to finish. And just real quick, and I apologize because this is complicated and I'm not going to be able to give you very much time. But, we've talked about the last election, about the fact that we have a new party that's in power and we have a new prime minister. And now apparently have been some charges of possible financial misdeeds in connection with fundraising that he and his party would be involved in. Who knows whether that will blow up or whether that will, as some people think, or that will blow over, as some people think. Is he in a vulnerable position now?
I mean, I think it's possible. There's certainly been certain kinds of scandals in earlier decades and in more recent times that have undermined the political support and power of a sitting prime minister. And Ozawa himself, who again is one of the premier the sort of the power behind the prime ministership here within the DPJ, himself had some earlier links to potential financial scandal of one kind or another. So I think there's that possibility, and the Japanese political system certainly responds to scandals that are considered severe enough. They're not just it goes on regularly, but if it gets hold in the media and seems to tarnish his kind of reforming image, I think it could have a dramatic effect. But I know so very little about the details of that case that it'd be hard for me to make guesses in the near term.
All right. Well, there we'll stop with our thanks to our guest, Scott O'Brien. He is associate professor in the Departments of History and East Asian Languages and Cultures, Indiana University, Bloomington. His recent book is The Growth Idea, Purpose and Prosperity in Postwar Japan. It is published by the University of Hawaii Press. And Professor O'Brien, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
And we also want to say thanks to John Shelton, who is the technical guy at the other end of our connection here between here and Bloomington. Thanks very much for being at the controls over there.